Welcome to Your Right to Speak, discussions on social justice and advocacy. This is episode 25. I'm your host, Salvatore. Jen, unfortunately, will not be with us today. Hopefully, we'll have her back on the next episode. On today's episode, we'll be talking about ethical politics with one of my old professors, Ian. And I'm very excited about this topic. I'm a bit green on it, and I would love to learn more about it and how we can connect it to young people. So, Ian, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I've been retired now for 4 years, but I'm semi-retired, which is how I got to know Salvatore, because I teach half of a half course a year. And I grew up in Alberta, thought I was going to be a lawyer, but other things kept coming along. Eventually went to graduate school at the University of Toronto, and I studied the courts, and especially unnecessary delays in the courts. And I guess I got interested in advocacy because when there are unnecessary delays, people suffer. Mm-hmm. But other people in the system, they just get used to it. And I think that's one of the biggest causes of suffering, is that people get used to the way things they are, the way things are, rather than trying to do something about it. I had a chance to work for Alberta Social Services after I finished my PhD, and worked in a number of different advocacy positions, helping people get access to the services that they needed, starting some preventive social services programs, working with First Nations reserves near Lethbridge. And at one point I was the person in charge of the funding of all the group homes in the southern region. Mm-hmm. So I got to know quite a bit about child welfare policy. And I got to know about the very wonderful advocacy groups for children and youth and for handicapped people. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of energy there. And it made me very grateful for the existence of advocates. Then I was lucky enough to get a job at York University in 1985. My wife was also lucky enough to get transferred by her accounting firm to Toronto. And at York University, I taught in political science for 25 years, mostly courses related to public administration and the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. I've written quite a bit about the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and judges. And then about 10 years ago, I became full-time in the new School of Public Policy and Administration at York University. And as a result of my own experience in the public service, I find that people who get into the public service, often they don't have a background in public administration, but they soon realize that they need it to move forward in their careers. So I helped to start the master's program where people in mid-career can take courses that will help them to move forward in their careers and do better in the work that they're doing. So in a sense, that that program, the MPPAL program, is an advocacy program for people that want to get ahead in their careers, but also people who want to help people and be more effective in doing it. So that's a little bit about myself.
Wow.
I have three kids, all of them adopted. One of them had very, very severe attention deficit disorder. I had to do a lot of advocacy for him. But anyway, he's on his feet now and doing very well, so it's worth it in the end.
Sounds like you've accomplished a lot. I hope to just touch the surface in my future accomplishments.
Oh, you're already doing it.
Oh, thank you.
Salvatore.
I guess we're just going to dive into it. A lot of our listeners may not know what ethical politics is. So I was wondering if you could explain what is ethical politics.
Right. It seems to me that we need really good people in politics, well-balanced people, people with a sense of public duty, people who want to make the world a better place. But if they see politics as being unethical, they don't want to get involved in it. They don't want to dirty their hands with that sort of slime. So I've always had an interest in trying to improve the political system to make things better so that the political system will attract good people, more good people. We do have a number of good people in the system already, but we need more. And the level of trust in our political institutions goes up if we can avoid political scandals. Mm-hmm. So together with my friend and colleague David Sugarman, in the 1990s, we started to organize workshops on ethics and politics. And this involved politicians, journalists, academics. What are the ethical issues in politics, and how can we address those issues successfully? And David and I got so excited about what we learned from these workshops, we wrote a book called Honest Politics in 1997. And a new edition of that book has just come out called Honest Politics Now. And what we do, first of all, is we set out a theoretical framework. What is ethical politics? Well, what we argue is that democracy is governance based on the principle of mutual respect. The principle of mutual respect is part of every major world religion. It's part of every society. It's an important value. So how do we build on that? Well, free and fair elections are based on mutual respect. The basic legal principles like the rule of law and the doctrine of fairness are based on mutual respect. And the rules about ethics and politics, about the Elections Act, about election financing and so on, all that is based on mutual respect. Mm-hmm. So basically, ethics and politics is how do we practice what we preach with regard to mutual respect? How do we make the system as fair as possible and to prevent people from taking advantage of the system for their own ends? So one important aspect of ethics and politics is avoiding conflicts of interest. A conflict of interest is where someone in the public sector, it could be a public servant, it could be an elected politician, tries to either consciously or unconsciously use public office for personal benefit rather than for the public benefit. So if there's ever a chance that anyone is in a conflict of interest, they have to withdraw from it. And right now, in every province, the federal government and many municipalities, we have conflict of interest commissioners or ethics commissioners, integrity commissioners. These are the people that help elected politicians to understand the rules, and they are a resource if someone thinks, well, am I in a conflict of interest or not? Mm-hmm. You can go to them and they'll help you understand the situation and avoid having your name on the front page of the paper as being accused of being in a conflict mm-hmm. of interest. So this system has actually worked out very, very well. And in the late 1980s, the media were just full of conflict of interest stories. You don't see very many anymore, except in the United States. Yes. They need to adopt our system. But in Canada, you don't see too many anymore because we have this new approach in place. People understand what conflicts of interest are much better than before. And I think most people are honest. And they get into ethical problems because they don't think about it, or they do something that everybody else is doing. Mm-hmm. So I think having this approach to conflict of interest really helps to draw better people into politics because there are many, many fewer scandals. Another area that is really important is lobbyists. Lobbyists are really important in a democracy, but if they get involved in what we call undue influence, using money to get their way, or doing special favors to get their way, that's unfair. Mm-hmm. It's a violation of mutual respect. So we have the lobbyist rules. Then there are various whistleblowing regimes now. Sometimes we see other people doing something wrong, but we're taking a chance if we point this out because we might be fired. Or worse than that, we might be accused of doing something terrible that we didn't do at all. And that could be used as a threat. So one recent innovation in political systems in Canada is having ways and means of protecting whistleblowers. We're not very good at it yet, but we're learning, we're getting better. So I'm very hopeful. I think that overall, Canada is a world leader in promoting ethics in our political system. But to become better, we need to start thinking, well, and we do think about ethics from the time that we're very, very young. When we go to school, we learn to try to treat our classmates with respect, to try to help the least advantaged. There are all kinds of anti-bullying programs. Mm-hmm. Bullying is definitely unethical. And it seems to me that if we can think about ethics issues and social justice issues, because they're very closely related, from a very early age, then we'll have no difficulty becoming politicians or public servants and doing the right thing.
I think that's a great explanation for our listeners. It sounds like mutual respect is a big piece to ethical politics. I'm just thinking now, what could some of the challenges be to, I guess, creating ethical politics or to ethical politics, or what might some of the challenges be faced by advocates for ethical politics?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges is hangovers from previous years or previous eras when unethical things happened. Mm-hmm. For example, when Canada was formed 150 years ago, the most contentious issue was our Senate. The reason that four provinces agreed to form a country was because they came to an agreement that we ought to have an appointed body, a group of politicians that would have their own chamber in Parliament, free from having to fight elections, because sometimes when you fight elections, you get involved in ethics issues. And if you have appointed people who are non-partisan, they can help to prevent the elected House of Commons from becoming overly partisan and corrupt. Mm-hmm. The problem was, soon after 1867, Senate appointments became very partisan. So, and the Senate, in fact, until very recently, has been a place where there were a lot of unethical practices. First of all, it was the chamber of Parliament where there was a lot of conflict of interest. Wealthy people wanted to get promoted to the Senate to advance their own interests or the interests of their companies or their sectors in society. They were anything but impartial. Once that began to diminish, the Senate became very, very partisan in favor of the party that appointed them, and really it prevented the Senate from doing the good things it should have been doing. As a result of the scandal involving Mike Duffy and Nigel Wright, the promise of Justin Trudeau that, well, we should go back to the 1867 model and have senators who were appointed because of their expertise rather than their partisan nature. Now we're almost in a position where the majority of senators have been appointed in a nonpartisan way, and they're starting to do some really wonderful things. Let me give you an example. The Senate recently came out with a report on unnecessary delays in the criminal justice system. It's a gem of a report. I testified before the committee that produced this report, and the senators were obviously really, really concerned about the injustice caused by unnecessary delays. They wanted to contribute to making society better. But they really didn't care. They weren't trying to promote the interests of the Conservatives or the Liberals or any particular party. They just wanted to come out with some recommendations that would be useful to society. So I think over time the Senate is going to become more and more useful because we have dealt with some of the ethics issues that prevented it from being so in the past. So that's one thing that we have to deal with, the legacy of the past, which has not always been ethical. Mm-hmm. Another is temptation. This is why we have internal auditors and external auditors, to try to make sure that organizations and companies are set up in such a way as to prevent people from being able to commit fraud and take money for themselves when they shouldn't. If the structure is not very good, so that people can see, gee, you know, just by signing this on this line, I could put $1 million into my bank account and no one will ever know about it. Wouldn't that be great for me and my family? And so they're tempted.
Mm-hmm.
And very often they react in kind of a knee-jerk way rather than thinking about, is this really the right thing to do? They don't sort of sit back and think, how does this relate to the basic principle of mutual respect?
Mm-hmm.
The temptation is there. So you have to prevent the temptation. My wife is an auditor, so I think she has a wonderful profession, because that's they try to make sure that people are as honest as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So we're lucky to live in a country where a lot of corruption has been overcome, but it's been overcome not easily. But if you look at really the history of Canada and then Great Britain and France before that. There's been a lot of bloodshed to get to where we are now, so that we have tackled a lot of corrupt issues. The major issues of corruption now are in developing countries, and the major cause of poverty in developing countries is corruption. And Canada, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, other countries are now taking steps to try to prevent their own nationals from being involved in foreign corruption.
Mm-hmm.
They're baby steps right now. I think that I tend to be an optimistic person, I think in 50 years we'll see a lot less global corruption. I think that we're seeing a reaction to improvements in the United States right now with Donald Trump, where he and his supporters didn't like the anti-corruption measures that were brought in by the Obama
right.
administration. They're trying to roll things back. I don't think they'll succeed. I think these bumps have to come along every once in a while. But it encourages honest people to get out there and say, look, let's defend the gains we've made, but let's improve the system further. Something that I think is obscene is the gap between the very, very wealthy and the average or poor people.
Yes.
All over the world. It's not just Canada. It's every country in the world that suffers from that. It's wrong. It's unethical. We have to address it in a way that's fair. So those are some of the challenges to being ethical.
Wow, it's a lot.
It is.
It sounds like we are moving, though, in, I guess, a positive direction.
At the moment, I think we're moving in a positive direction.
Mm-hmm. So I did some research on this topic because I am a bit green on it. And what came up in my research is that one of the aspects to political politics is ethics and policy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So how can policymakers address, I guess, their own stigmas around certain topics or communities when developing policy?
Well, that's a very good question. So ethics needs to be not just individual, but it needs to be, there needs to be ethics and policies
mm-hmm.
as well. So the question that those making policies need to ask, who's benefiting from these policies? How can we improve these policies so that more people who need these benefits can actually get these benefits?
Right.
How can we do this in a cost-effective way? So that requires research. So when I worked for Alberta Social Services, I headed up a couple of big research projects, one involving services for the handicapped, the other involving child welfare. So for services for the handicapped, we actually interviewed physically and mentally handicapped people who were getting services and asking how they could be improved, plus their supporters, their advocates.
Mm-hmm.
How can these policies be improved? It was the first time that had been done. Before that time, it was just assumed that the policymakers, because they had a university education,
right.
knew the best and they could come up with really good policies. That isn't necessarily so. You have to ask the people who who are affected by the policies, how can this be improved? And you have to keep asking, because the environment changes year after year after year. Same with child welfare. No one in the world, I don't think, had interviewed children 9 years old and older about the services that they were getting, whether they were in foster homes, whether they were in group homes, or just somehow in some kind of preventive social services program, like Big Brothers or Sisters. And what we found was that kids receiving the most intensive services were not getting the services that they needed, because they blamed themselves for being in that situation. It was never, or almost never, their fault. It was the blame, if it should have been placed anywhere, would be with their parents or their foster parents or their school, but not with the kids. Mm-hmm. But they blamed themselves, and they needed to find out that, you know, no, this is what's happening. You're the victim. You're not the cause of this situation. Now, where can we go from there? And the other thing is that 80% of the kids receiving services who've been taken away from their families wanted to be back with their families. And they were having a lot of psychological difficulties just being away from their families. Mm-hmm. Bad as their families might have been for them. So wouldn't it have been a lot better to leave them with their families but plug in services with their families? So once again, you have to ask, not just assume that policies are good, but ask the people that are getting them, how can we improve them? How can we be better? And that means you have to have a thick skin. You have to be willing to listen to criticism. Mm-hmm.
That warms my heart, because a lot of what I've done in my academic studies and my professional career has been around lived experience and really listening to the lived experiences of young people, because they have such unique perspectives, and there's value in the knowledge that they carry.
Yes.
It's very different from how we adults understand the world today. Often, you know, my last few episodes, we talked about, with another guest, anti-oppressive framework.
Mm-hmm.
And what came out a bit in that discussion was how policymakers need to have more anti-oppressive training that will then trickle down into their policy development. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Well, very often oppression is going on and the people doing the oppression don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 1997, I was appointed an associate dean in the old Faculty of Arts, and one of my responsibilities was labor relations. And so if a group of students complained about a professor, then I had to investigate. And I got one day 10 students from a class of 15 come in with very serious complaints about their professor. Mm-hmm. So I phoned the professor up and said, I just received some complaints, I'd like to talk to you, I'd like to hear your side of it. Well, 5 minutes later, the union rep from the professor came in and said, I just had one of my union members in tears in my office. And I said, I don't understand, because I was very polite on the phone. I just said I wanted to talk to him and hear his side. He said, Ian, you don't understand. You're an associate dean. You're somebody with a lot of power now. You don't see yourself that way, but you have a lot of power.
Right.
You have to recognize that. And when you interact with people, you have to act in such a way so that they don't feel oppressed by your power. Mm-hmm. What a wonderful lesson that was.
Yeah.
I'm glad it occurred within the first few days of being associate dean, or I would have carried on making the same mistakes and not being aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, anti-oppression training would have certainly helped me. Of course, I would not have thought I needed it, because I don't believe in oppression.
Right.
But how could I oppress other people? Well, it's one example of how you can unwittingly oppress other people.
Yeah, it sounds like that often what could happen is, although some policymakers don't believe in oppression, there's not a full, I guess, recognition of the power that they hold.
That's right.
Right, yeah. And they kind of become, I guess, blind to it. I don't know if that's the right way to say it, but... So I just want to move it a little bit because we're almost near the end, and I have two questions that I feel like I need to ask.
Okay.
Since we're talking about politics, I was wondering, you know, how do you think we can include children as well as youth to be engaged more in politics? And how can we break down, I guess, the barriers that adults have that children should not be participating in politics until they're a certain age?
Well, I think grade 4 is about the right age to start kids getting in, having an interest in politics. And what I used to do as a parent volunteer in my kids' school was I organized a model parliament for grades 4 to 6 in their school. And through that experience, actually having elections, having a government and an opposition, and committees studying policy of various kinds, and bills being introduced and debated, they got to understand how the system worked, and they had a lot of fun. So at the very end of the year, we went to the Ontario legislature, and we would have a tour of the legislature, and always the tour guide would say, these kids, grades 4 to 6, know more than most university students that come in here. So once you, and many of these kids have gone on to, well, I kept in touch with them through my kids. They voted in the last election. They have opinions, well thought out opinions. They know the difference between fake news and real news. So you have to start that early. In Norway, there are mock or model parliaments for kids starting about that age, right through to high school. And before they graduate from high school, they participate in all the kids throughout Norway in a model parliament. And the model parliament building is located across the street from the regular parliament buildings. They have the best civics education in the world. So that's what we could do. I think we could model ourselves in Norway.
So it sounds like maybe we should possibly include that in the education sector, the education
system.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking about it now. That's such a great idea. I didn't start learning about politics until high school, and it was like civics class, right? And at that point, whether I had interest in it, like...
It all depends who your civics teacher is.
Yes. But, I mean, that's such a unique, I think, and great idea. And it really, to me, speaks that if we do that, we as adults then are recognizing that young people have the capability to really understand politics, right? And really recognizing that they have something to say of what's happening in their country, what's happening in the government, and we should listen to them. So I love that. That's great. We're near the end, and I have to ask our lovely trademark question that we've been asking everyone. What does advocacy mean to you?
Advocacy means trying to open my eyes to people who are suffering and asking, is there something that I can do to make things better? And that doesn't mean jumping in where I'm not welcome or not needed or I could make things worse, but just being open to situations that come along every single day and asking, is there something that I can do here? Can I be an advocate? Many times I can't be. I can learn from the situation, I can watch, but... there's nothing that I can do to help. I met a student a few minutes ago before coming here, just by chance, who was talking about doing a PhD in a particular area that I knew something about. So I realized right away I can be an advocate for you, both in terms of helping you find a good university to go to and helping to steer you in the right direction in terms of a research proposal. I given what she was telling me, I thought, I can save you a lot of trouble. So I'm going to get you to know you better. I'm not going to jump in and say, here, I've got some great ideas for you. But let's go to lunch. I'll share some of my ideas. If she likes them, she'll follow through. And she might ask for more. that she's welcome to reject my ideas too. But, you know, I was in the right place at the right time.
It sounds like your meaning of advocacy is really not forcing upon your ideas on mm-hmm. another person, but it's just offering them and allowing mm-hmm. the person to take with it what they need
yes.
or want.
Yes.
I think that's a great way to look at it. It's a definition that I have not gotten yet, so thank you for that.
And, you know, I used to think that once you turn 65, you've learned everything you need to know, and you just kind of sit around and enjoy life for as long as you've got. But no, we learn something every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we're sensitive to what's going on around us, we can become more effective advocates. We can learn from our mistakes, and we can use the time that we have in this world to make it a better place.
I think that's a great way to end this conversation. Before we end, do you have anything else to say?
Do I have anything else to say? Well, I hope people might take a look at the new book, Honest Politics Now, and give me some feedback. many people say honest politics is an oxymoron. No, it shouldn't be an oxymoron. 1,000 years ago, an honest judge was an oxymoron. It's not anymore. took a few centuries to change. We need to move forward to a society that is more ethical, where people care about each other more. And we need to get there in a nonviolent way, but we'll only get there through advocacy.
Well, thank you, Ian, for taking the time out to speak with me today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
It was a great conversation. I have learned a lot, and I know she would have loved this conversation too if she was here. Your right to speak will be posted on the second Wednesday of every month. Thank you again for taking the time out. If you are a child or youth that would like to be on the show, or if you have an idea of a topic that you think we should be talking about, please email me or Jen at yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. That's yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. Let's raise awareness together.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.